The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, everybody. I'm Marcine Mattelman, and I'm a member of the board of the Foundation of the Free Library, and we have another wonderful night here. Many of you I saw last week, and many of you I see all the time here. Like many of you, my love affair with books started way back, from weekly visits to the George Branch when I was young, to many times a week coming to this building, where great things are happening, and there are exciting plans for the future for expansion. I know you've heard about them already. For me, the library is the most exciting cultural institution on the Parkway. I particularly love books written by women and have introduced Judith Viorst and Maureen Dowd from this podium. Tonight continues that tradition, introducing two outstanding authors, Anita Diamond and Myla Goldberg, in that order. Myla Goldberg and Anita Diamond in that order. Myla Goldberg became a household word 5 years ago with her debut novel, Bee Season. There have been several books written recently with bees in the title, but this one stands out. So much so that it's being made into a feature film that will be released this fall, starring Richard Gere and Juliette Binoche. Born in Maryland in 1972, I checked, she is that young, by the way. She graduated from Oberlin, she taught in Prague and the Czech Republic, and then at 28, can you imagine that, she wrote Bee Season. It was a surprise hit that enabled her to quit her job as a freelance reader for a film company. But I wasn't surprised that it was well received. If you read the book about family, religion, Eliza, you won't forget it. Myla Goldberg, now a mother and well-known author, is here tonight to discuss her new book, Wicket's Remedy, also about family. The family in Bee Season is Jewish, and Wicket is Irish. Living in Boston during 1918 Spanish flu epidemic, which I learned killed more Americans in 10 months than died in all the 20th century wars together. It will be hard for you to put the book down. Our second star of the evening, and it is the second star, is Anita Diamond, who published her first novel, The Red Tent, in 1997, and she hasn't stopped since. Thanks to reader recommendations, book groups, and independent bookstores, the book became a long-running New York Times bestseller with 2.6 million copies in print. Inspired by a reference to Dinah, Jacob's daughter, in Genesis 34, the novel transports the reader to the lives of biblical women, their rituals, their trials, and their intrigues. I loved it, and if you think contemporary women are strong, read what Anita Diamond has done in creating the matriarchs. She sits written many handbooks on Jewish practice, Jewish life, and lifestyles, and recently one with a very interesting title, Pitching My Tent on Marriage, Motherhood, and Other Leaps of Faith. Ms. Diamond is a recipient of more than a dozen journalistic and literary awards, including the 2001 Book Censor Book of the Year. Her new book, which she'll talk about this evening, jumps many centuries. The Last Days of Dogtown is about a small group of outcasts living in a ghost town in Cape Ann. Like The Red Tent, it rests on historical records, and you will enjoy it thoroughly. It's my honor and privilege to be part of tonight's program with such exceptional authors. I know you're as eager to meet them as I was. Anita Diamond, Myla Goldberg.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for coming out tonight. I'm Myla, and you heard a little bit, new book called Wicket's Remedy, and you did hear, I think, only halfway heard. So mostly set during the 1918 influenza epidemic, which I became strangely obsessed by about 5 years ago and therefore had to write about. And it centers on a woman named Lydia Wicket. The part I'm going to read for you tonight is the influenza epidemic is in full effect, and Lydia is right smack in the middle of it. She had spent a day volunteering at a hospital in South Boston, which is where she lives, and had realized that she had to do something. Like, this epidemic was just kind of a call to arms for her. And so, contrary to every instinct, she decides to respond to an ad that had been placed in the paper of a government study that is going to be happening on an island in Boston Harbor. She has no experience, but she decides that she has to go and apply for the job. And so, this is what you're going to hear is from that passage. Oh, one more thing. They always say that, don't they? They're about to start, and they're like, oh, but wait. One of the interesting things about this book is you're going to get more than one perspective. In addition to getting Lydia's story, there's voices that run along the margin of this book, and those are the voices of the mysterious dead who are listening in on what's going on, and they've got their own opinions about what's going on, because as I think we all know, memory is not to be relied upon, either individual or collective. And so I'm going to be giving you a little sample of those voices too as I go along, and I think you'll be able to figure out what's what. The streetcar driver wore a mask. A handwritten sign above his head read, "If you're feeling sick, please do not ride. I have a wife and family." Gerard Davis holds that sign one part responsible for his abiding good health, the second part being hot whiskey. The last time Lydia rode the streetcar into Boston, people had sung as they made their way to the sailors' parade, but the streetcar was no longer a place where people even exchanged greetings. When a man sitting toward the middle of the car coughed, the passengers around him recoiled as if snakes had slithered from his mouth. The trolley made its way over the bridge to reveal a city of empty streets and shuttered stores. Lydia had not counted on the sight of Boston free of traffic. Until now, her cognizance of the epidemic's breadth had been as provincial as her first conception of the war. Newspapers had described the flu's effect in Boston and elsewhere, but their full meaning was easily upstaged by daily circumstances. The sight of the city shut down vivified all that newsprint. Boston's shuttered storefronts had their equals in Philadelphia and New York and Washington, D.C. All across New England and the East Coast, there were hospitals like Kearney in South Boston, overflowing with the desperately ill. And in the past few days, newspapers had reported flu making inroads west. Riding the streetcar, Lydia imagined a United States map like the one her husband had purchased of the war in Europe, but this time she populated it with pushpins of a single color, pushpins that did not represent an army, but a disease. She debarked on Tremont Street. Morning here felt miscued, as if flu had muddled the earth's diurnal rhythm. Such a deserted street ought to have belonged to the dark, anonymous hours of night. She began striding, and then running, toward Boylston Street. Of all the buildings on the block, her destined address was the liveliest, but its activity was not a blow against the epidemic. It was a marker of it. These were the offices of the Public Health Service. Inside the front lobby, a sign instructed each visitor to don a gauze mask from a box beside the door. A masked receptionist directed Lydia to a small elevator, which she shared with two masked officials carrying briefcases. Jefferson Carver, the Public Health Service's first colored elevator operator and the car's fourth occupant, has become resigned to his omission from the partial memories of his white passengers. At the sight of the briefcases, Lydia realized the extent of her folly. She was riding an elevator to meet a man who did not expect her, in order to apply for a position for which she was not qualified and which would fill her family with dread. She examined her clothes. She had been too tired to clean her shirtwaist the night before. Several small stains dotted the sleeve and collar. One of them was likely blood. The elevator door opened. According to the lobby receptionist, Mr. Corey's office was just beyond the elevator. To the right, an open doorway cast a slanted oblong of light into the darker corridor. Lydia started toward it and then turned around. If she stopped now, she could leave without anyone ever knowing she had come.
"Hello?"
came a voice from inside the room. She heard a chair scrape against the floor. A head was silhouetted in the hallway.
"Hello, miss?"
a man called as Lydia willed the elevator to return.
"Is there something I can help you with?"
"I'm sorry. I made a mistake," Lydia apologized. "I had come about the notice."
"Oh, you mean that Gollops Island project?"
the man asked.
"Yes," Lydia answered, "but I don't..."
"Don't worry," he assured her.
"You've made no mistake. Did we have an appointment? No matter, you're here. Please, do stop standing beside the elevator. If word gets out that I let you go without interviewing you, I'll never hear the end of it." His head disappeared from the hallway, then reemerged. Are you coming? Good. The head withdrew. Lydia retrieved the listing from her pocket. Sweat from frequent fingerings had blotted the words into illegibility and fuzzed the paper's edges so that it more closely resembled lint. She smoothed the scrap against her dress and folded it in half before returning it to her pocket. Then she followed the man in. H.G. Corey's office was a small, cramped room whose walls were adorned with health advisory posters. Its single window was open to its limit, allowing a brisk breeze into the room. In spontaneous defense against the open window, the haphazard piles of paper concealing the desk had been secured by objects not originally intended as paperweights. A daunting metal medical instrument anchored one pile. A soda bottle topped another. Mr. Corey was a frenetic man with shoulders that sloped as if also weighed by random objects. The gauze mask across his nose and mouth looked oversized on his small face. "The office is a mess, I'm afraid, but don't let that scare you," he said. "There should be a chair here somewhere." "Thank you," Lydia replied, "but I don't want to waste your time."
"You're confusing me, miss."
"Miss, what is your name?"
"Wickett."
"First name?"
"Lydia."
"Miss Lydia Wickett, if you came about the Gallup's Island position, then you are most assuredly not wasting my time. You're a nurse, are you not?" Mr. Corey was bent over in his chair, opening and closing various drawers in search of something, the piles on his desk obscuring him from view.
No, she answered.
"Well then, that's all." He straightened in his chair and was again visible from the shoulders up. She was reminded of a mole popping in and out of his hole. "Did you say that you're not a nurse?"
"That's right. I really am sorry. I'll just leave you to your..."
"You'll just..." He shook his head with quick, sharp movements. "No, please, not yet, if you don't mind. You say you're not a nurse. Then what are you?"
"Pardon?"
Mr. Corey had produced a paper from one of his drawers. "You must have experience, or else you wouldn't have come, yes?"
"Well, yes. I volunteered at Kearney Hospital," she began, hungry to tell someone, even if only a stranger. "When I brought a neighbor's child there, it was already overcrowded. But then when I returned the next day, there were so many ill that they'd been forced to put tents on the lawn."
"So you're a nurse's aide, then?" Corey asked as he wrote, once again obscured by the papers on his desk. "And how long have you been at Kearney Hospital?"
"Just one day," she replied.
Corey stopped writing. "One day." At Kearney, masks had seemed appropriate, but here, inside an otherwise normal office building, they gave the conversation the feel of a waking dream.
"Yes," she acknowledged. "You see, I oughtn't to have come. It's one thing to volunteer, but to seek a position, an official position."
She rose from her chair. "Good day, Mr. Corey."
"Please, Miss Wickett," Mr. Corey coaxed. "You would be doing me a great service if you allowed me to finish this interview."
He held up his paper. "I've already begun to fill out the form, you see." She sat.
"Age?"
23.
"Address?"
28 D Street. The mask made it impossible to read his face. He returned his attention to the desk. His window looked out onto windows of other buildings. Without a view of the street, she could almost pretend the city was unchanged.
"It's really quite good of you to bear with me," Mr. Corey continued. "Just a few more questions, and then we'll be done. Have you any children?"
"No, sir."
"Are you a drinking woman?"
"Certainly not," she retorted.
"Good," he sighed gratefully. "Due to the extreme circumstance, some of the hospitals have begun accepting personnel with handicaps of various sorts, but that won't do here," he explained. "We had one respondent, a lovely woman, but then she had some trouble, and that scotched it." "Oh, dear, I believe I just made a pun." Corey paused and eyed the paperwork arrayed before him. "You'll have to forgive me, Mrs. Lydia Wickett. It's been a very long week." "You don't have a fever, do you?"
"No, sir."
"Aches, fatigue, cough, congestion?"
"No, sir."
"Excellent. It is likely to be a 2-week study, but it could go as long as a month. Influenza transmission headed by Dr. Gold. We've got to sort out how many people are catching this thing if we want to stop it, and I'm sure I don't have to tell you that Dr. Gold..."
"Sir?"
"Well, exactly. Any other time, and people would be clamoring to work with him. You will live and work on Gallup's Island, where you'll be expected to assist the nurses and doctors. Food and lodging will be provided. Salary is $20 a week."
"Sir," she replied, "you did hear all that I said?" Mr. Corey consulted his paperwork.
Well, let's see. Your name is Lydia Wickett. You have limited hospital experience. You have no dependents. You are not a drunk, and you are not ill. Is that correct? Yes, but Lydia Wickett, including yourself, do you know how many candidates I currently have under consideration for this position? She shook her head. One. And while you are not ideal, you are infinitely better than no candidate at all. I don't need to tell you, Mrs. Wickett, these are desperate times. Desperate times call for measures. Would you like the position? Her hands were shaking. She had felt this way only once before, a lifetime ago, when she received Henry's first love letter. That moment, like this one, had been gilded with a sense of its own history, born knowing that its details would be carefully remembered and recounted. Mr. Corey, she answered slowly, measuring each word on her tongue. I want to be, I am meant to be, a nurse. I am as sure of this as I have ever been about anything. Well, Mrs. Wickett, I cannot think of a better time for you to have made such a discovery. Does that mean your answer is yes? Along one wall were several wooden cabinets labeled with the word personnel. From this day onward, there would be a file inside one of them bearing her name. She committed to memory the high ceiling, the smell of pipe tobacco, and the way the sun through the window framed Mr. Corey's figure in yellow light. Yes, she replied. Thank you.
It's great to be here. It's always good to be in Philadelphia. I'm going to take you back to Massachusetts. My book, The Last Days of Dogtown, is also a historical novel. It's set in a little bit earlier than Milo's. It's in the early 1800s, 1820 to 1830, just north of Boston on Cape Ann, which was also the setting of my second novel, Good Harbor, which was a contemporary novel. This book was inspired by a little pamphlet that I picked up about 10 years ago. I'm going to read you the author's note first, which, unlike some author's notes, which are fictional and really meant to be part of the story, is, in fact, my voice directly to you, the reader, about the genesis of this book. So this is the author's note from The Last Days of Dogtown. This is a work of fiction that rests lightly upon the historical record, which is spotty at best when it comes to the village of Dogtown. There was once such a hamlet, set on the high ground at the heart of Cape Ann. You can find signs directing you to its ruins on that rocky fist of coastland, the northernmost boundary of Massachusetts Bay. A local pamphlet, Dogtown, a Village Lost in Time, may still be available for purchase in the bookshops of Gloucester and Rockport, which was known as Sandy Bay until 1840. This little publication contains a not wholly accurate walking map of the area and some tales about the more vivid characters said to live there long ago. Most accounts of Dogtown's last visit citizens rely heavily upon a volume of 31 pages published in 1906 called In the Heart of Cape Ann, or The Story of Dogtown. Illustrated by Catherine M. Follinsby, who had a fondness for drawing witches astride their brooms, it was written by Charles E. Mann. In his prefatory note, Mr. Mann revealed that nearly all his material was gleaned from, quote, the memories of Cape Ann's aged people, sweet-faced old ladies, often with sweeter voices, or men with whitened locks and time-furrowed cheeks, recalling the stories told them by the fireside by other dear old women and noble old men of a past century, end quote. In other words, ancient gossip and hearsay. I tell you this so you will not make the mistake of confusing my fancies for facts. And yet, the death of a village, even one as poor and small as Dogtown, is not an altogether trivial thing. Surely there was value in the quiet lives lived among those imposing boulders under that bright sky. Why not imagine their stories as real, if not true? For the space of this entertainment, where's the harm? And with that, I launch into the stories of a handful of characters on Cape Ann. Cape Ann is a rocky place. It was left by the glaciers long ago, and there are huge boulders strewn around Cape Ann, and geologists call these boulders eccentrics. And the handful of people who were the last residents of Dogtown, which was the original settlement of Cape Ann and the center of Cape Ann, were also eccentrics, each and every one of them. This book is very much a character study of these last citizens of Dogtown, who I discovered by reading this pamphlet many years ago. And I want to introduce you to a few of those characters tonight in the short time that we're given here. I'm going to introduce you to Easter Carter, who was in some ways the mayoress of the place, who had the largest home and lived to have people in her house. Her dear friend Judy Rhines, who is a solitary woman, a spinster, and Black Ruth, who is also known as John Woodman, who was one of the last two Africans on Cape Ann at the time. And this setting is the story that there is some evidence that such a thing did happen, and so now I will introduce you to these three ladies. The settlement of Dogtown was more and more like a cracked pitcher. In the 3 years following Abraham Worth's death, the village leaked life at a steady pace. But chatter over such things and virtually everything else came to a halt with the sighting of a sea serpent in Gloucester Harbor. Easter didn't believe it at first. A twisted ankle and a string of rainy days had kept her from hearing it any sooner. "You're having fun with a poor cripple," she said, her ankle propped on the bench and wrapped in an old tea towel. "It seems to be true," said Judy Rhines, who'd brought the news along with a jar of preserves. "More people say they've seen it every day." Boats were out hunting the beast with spyglasses, hooks, and nets at the ready. A fellow named Cheever Felch had come up from Boston and was making a name for himself, claiming that the monster was 100 feet in length and dark brown in color, with white markings at the throat. Judy had overheard Reverend Felch herself. A man of the church and a self-taught naturalist, he'd been repeating his story to the young Boston newspaper man who'd scribbled it down amid a crowd of jostling boys on Front Street. A group of the town ladies had been drawn to the scene, too. Judy had thought them lovely in their straw bonnets and white cotton summer frocks, freshly pressed and spotless. Soft Moroccan slippers peeked out from beneath their clean hems, prompting her to pull at her gray skirt to hide the unfashionably pointed brogans on her feet. "You sure it wasn't a whale?" Easter said. "Sometimes those whales can fool you." "It weren't no whale," said Ruth, who'd been standing just outside the door listening to Judy's report. Judy jumped up from her seat, startled at the African woman's sudden appearance. Easter smiled. "You sure you ain't making this up for fun? You seen it?" "I seen it," said Ruth. "Longer and thinner, like a kind of a snake, but a snake the like of which you didn't see before." Ruth's speech was marked by extra syllables in the most unlikely words, so that snake came out sounding like snake, echoing a voice from her past. "In Africa, they see such quite common," Ruth went on. "You don't say," Judy said, trying not to sound like she wasn't bursting with questions for the last Black woman on Cape Ann. When Ruth had arrived and the secret of her sex had been revealed, people had stared and debated the weird and oddly threatening presence of an African woman who wore men's clothing, took a man's name, and practiced a man's trade. She was a stonemason. But over the years, her reticence had worn down all objections so that eventually the minor discrepancy of John Woodman's gender was more or less forgotten. "I thought you came from Rhode Island," Judy said, studying Ruth's long, impassive face and trying to catch her downcast eye. "African woman there, she told it to me. She remembered things from over there, like horses with necks to the treetops and birds with colors like a rainbow, sea creatures like the size of a house, but no whales. She never seen no whales before America." It was the longest speech either Judy or Easter had ever heard her deliver. Easter grinned and said, "Well, well, well." Embarrassed, Ruth hurried up the narrow stairs, ducking her head on the way up. Judy realized she'd never once seen Ruth sit down, not in Easter's house or anywhere else. Judy dropped her voice. She ever eat with you? Mostly not. She takes it outside or upstairs, Easter said. When I had the miseries last winter and we got snowed in, she did me a load of favors, hauled water and brought in a clutch of eggs for supper. Ruined a nice piece of ham, though. She put enough pepper on the meat to make it get up and gallop right out of the pan. It was good of her all the same. You never did tell me how she came to be here from Narragansett, said Judy. Well, I ain't sure I got the whole story to tell. Ruth listened to their conversation from her pallet above stairs. The eaves seemed to collect words and drop them directly into her ears so she didn't miss a whisper that was spoken below. She'd heard all manner of secrets and scandals confided in that parlor, and she'd learned that Easter repeated nothing except what was light and harmless and already well known. Her Mimba had been right about white people. The best thing was to treat them like ghosts and cannibals, not to be trusted. But sometimes a white ghost would look at you straight on with a full smile, eye to eye. The smile of the eye was the secret Mimba had taught her. You had to be careful always, but every now and again you could act as though they had souls too. Easter was one like that. So with that, you start to inhabit this world of lonely women off in the woods who are forgotten by the townspeople, more or less. Dogtown was the original settlement, as I said. It's only about a mile and a half outside of Gloucester, but it's up a very rocky and difficult road, which in the winter would feel like many, many miles away from town. I want to read one other section about another group of characters in the book who are the dogs. Dogtown is actually a generic name for a rural slum. So there are dog towns in Nevada and in California. There's a neighborhood in St. Louis also known as Dogtown. And so it was a name that was ascribed to a place that was on the skids, a place where dogs might have roamed free, and a place where the dogs are seen to take over and become kind of a almost supernatural presence. But in here, the dogs are sort of a next-door neighborhood, and I've lost the place, so you'll have to forgive me. Myla and I are both new on the tour. You get us both fresh at the beginning, but it means that I lose my place more than I used to. I'm sorry. One second. Okay. This is about the dogs and Ruth and the relationship between Ruth and the pack of dogs. This is toward the end of the book. Ruth is one of the very last people left in Dogtown. At this point, there are really only two, herself and Cornelius Finson. Ruth visited the dogs in their high meadow. She had kept her distance at first, no closer than 50 feet the first year. She crept to within 40 feet the next summer, 20 the following year, until she was close enough to stretch out her hand and touch them. Not that she ever did any such thing, nor did she make any sudden moves or speak a single word, thus proving herself trustworthy, or at least tolerable. Studying the dogs, she had learned how to live within herself entirely, to sit without expectation, to rest, eyes half closed, and panting through the stifling heat, sniffing subtle changes in the air, succumbing to sleep when it came. The dogs were neither noisy nor silent, neither idle nor busy. They snored and sighed, coughed, scratched, and snapped at buzzing passers-by. They stood and stretched, ambled to the bushes to lift a leg or crouch, returned to shade or tall grass to circle and settle again. They smelled one another lazily, chewed on the grass, lifted their chins to follow the motion of a bird or a scent on the wind. Ruth passed whole days among them, floating through time like it was warm water. Ruth took note of the greening trees and began to look forward to the coming summer afternoons, but her anticipation was undercut with dread, too, for the pack was dwindling fast. When Ruth first arrived in Dogtown, there were nearly 25 dogs in the hills, living like a nearby but separate neighborhood, at peace with the people next door, a little standoffish perhaps, but friendly enough. By the time Easter moved down to Gloucester, there were no more than 8 of them left, and those few were bony and mangy. That spring, Ruth caught sight of the last breeding-age female, waddling and swollen with puppies, and hoped there might yet be a future for the pack, but the litter was stillborn, and the mother lost too much blood in her labors and died as well. Ruth found Brindle's body in the woods a few weeks later, his ribs showing beneath his dull, dusty fur, and she buried him where he lay. In August, she counted the last 6 dogs sprawled in their sun-baked pasture overlooking the sea. Ruth turned at the sound of a rasping sigh and watched as Brownie sank gently into death, as if the earth were welcoming his body home. The tan got to her feet immediately and padded to Brownie's side, where she lay down with her head on her paws. Ruth knew that she was mourning her companion, though not in the manner of men and women who make much of themselves when death takes a loved one. Her sorrow seemed purely selfless by comparison. The other dogs made a show of shaking their coats and sneezing before they walked into the forest, leaving Tan to absorb her loss alone. Ruth fetched a shovel so she would not have to watch the crows pick the dog's body clean. Tan was still there when she returned, but walked away when Ruth started to dig a small oval hole, which hugged the curled-up corpse in a neat embrace. The sight of the sea caught Ruth's eye as she wiped the dirt from her hands, and she felt an involuntary shiver of pleasure at being alive. She was not quite one of the dogs, she thought, kneeling to arrange a cairn of stones on top of the freshly turned earth. It felt good to finish something properly, even if it was something as inconsequential as piling rocks over the bones of a wild dog. Thank you.
Hi. So for those of you who have not joined us before, what we'll do at this point is we'll have a Q&A. You'll raise your hands. I'll call on you. Please, please wait for the microphone because we record these and archive them so people who couldn't make it can check them out at some point. First question, please.
Don't be shy. Come on.
Okay, well then. Thanks for coming. And okay, gentleman in front. Dan?
Hi, this is a question for Anita. We have a book group here that we're in the middle of reading the Red Tent. And I'm interested in knowing can you talk a little bit about the moment of sort of discovering the story of Dina, kind of how you thought about the beginning development of that book, and then sort of a little bit about the process of writing it and any particular challenges you faced?
Thank you. I wrote The Red Tent because I had been writing nonfiction for 25 years and I needed a new challenge, so I thought I would try a novel. And I thought actually I would write a book about the relationship between Rachel and Leah, the two sisters who are married to Jacob. And so I went to look at the story again and read through Genesis to the story of Dina and found a great plot, which those of you who've read the book know is full of sex and violence and betrayal and greed. And in the Bible, Dina doesn't say anything. She's completely silent. So true to my experience as a journalist, to go to a character off to the side, a minor character, and tell the story through those eyes is a time-honored trick of journalists and also of novelists. But so I decided to tell the story from her perspective and give her a voice and give her agency in it. The research I did for the book was mostly to prevent mistakes and anachronisms, so no one's eating chickens or looking at a wristwatch or doing anything that would have been out of time. And because so little is known about this character and because she says nothing, I felt a great sense of freedom in being able to do pretty much what I wanted with the story. I hope that begins to answer that a little bit.
Another question? Gentleman back here.
I'd like to ask both of you about how you went about writing it, or your books. Did you have an outline? Or did you just sit down and write? Did you do any rewriting? I'm curious about the whole process.
All right. I'll talk about the most recent book, I guess, in answer to that question, although a lot of this applies to, for me, for writing in general.
The book was inspired for me when I was reading the New York Times, and I saw a list that gave the 5 worst epidemics of all time, and the 1918 influenza pandemic was listed, and I had just never, ever heard of it, and I was shocked by not having heard of it. And so the more reading I did on that topic, the more I realized I absolutely had to write about this because it was a crime that had been so soundly and roundly forgotten by so many people. Writing for me is a lot of the adventure is finding out what's going to happen next. I am definitely not an outliner. If I was outlining something, I think I'd just kind of curl up and die. Like, it's just, I can't imagine a more boring way to go about writing. The danger of that is it can take an awfully long time to figure out what you're talking about. And so that was definitely a problem, especially with this book, which has a lot of different kinds of texts and a lot of different things happening, and it requires a lot of structure. And so I have notebooks that I take notes in, and I might have a paragraph where I write about a particular character or my overarching goal for the book, but the actual nitty-gritty all comes out in the writing. And rewriting, oh yeah. Oh, yeah. With this particular book, I actually had a completed draft about 2.5 years. This was a 5-year process, 5 years of full-time writing. And 2.5 years into it, I had a completed draft. I showed it to some friends who were very valued readers for me, and they were friends who loved me enough to tell me when I suck. And they read it, and they're like, you know what? This is just not very good. And they were right. And thank goodness they had the strength to tell me that. And so I basically trashed the whole thing and started from page one again. So...
I don't write with an outline either. I can't imagine writing with an outline. I don't actually know any writers who write novels anyway with outlines. And when I've written nonfiction books, I write outlines constantly, but I'm revising them all the time. I mean, I've never started with, and there's sort of a table of contents for me, but that, it changes as I write the book, even in nonfiction. But with fiction, it's a process of discovering what's going to happen next. I may have an idea of the beginning and the end, kind of. I don't know how I'm going to get from the beginning until I get to the end. And I think writing is rewriting. And I find rewriting easier than writing, than composing. And so I kind of enjoy the process of rewriting. It took me about 3.5 years to write this book, too. And it was very heavily revised as well. I'm in a writing group with 2 other very trusted friends who are writers, who also tell me when things need to be fixed and changed, and I do the same for them, lovingly. Not so different.
Gentleman in back here.
I'd like to ask 2 questions, if I could. One is, both of you seem to have taken on a challenge by choosing eras that are not within our recognition or recollection, 100, 200 years almost. Does that present a greater challenge for you to develop various explanations or descriptions of that era? You had to do more work than writing about something that we recall or contemporary issues. The other question is, I assume you wrote with word processing. You didn't write in longhand. Can you imagine doing this work by any other means than what you use now? I mean, is it so ingrained that, and with, especially with rewriting and so on, that you really couldn't do it with longhand?
I couldn't do it by longhand. I don't think I would have ever written a book without a computer. My first computer was a K-Pro. Anybody remember K-Pro? Oh. It's like a sewing machine. It was like this piece. Laptop, you know, the original laptop. It weighed, I don't know, 75 pounds. I actually feel like hardwired that my hands and my brain work together, and then I do touch type since high school anyway. So I go straight to that. I consider myself a journeyman novelist. This is my 3rd novel. 2 of them have been historical, and 1 was contemporary. And I feel a sense of freedom in the past, actually, so far. I don't know if I wrote something in 1918 where there's so much of a record, but I find a great deal of freedom. And then, in fact, the 1 contemporary novel I wrote, I was much more nervous about the research in that and getting it right, because I knew that if I got it wrong, everybody would know, or at least people who had been through breast cancer treatment would know right away that I didn't know what I was talking about, both in terms of the medicine and the emotion. So I was much more nervous about getting the facts right, and by that I mean not just the facts, but the emotional realities and psychological realities. So for me, it's freeing.
Oh yes, word processor, and no, can't imagine. Oh my God, what hell? So that's the first question. And then the research thing. Yeah, 1918. I mean, I didn't set out wanting to write a historical novel per se as my second book. I did set out wanting to write a novel as humanly different from my first book as possible. That was very important to me, but I didn't know what form that was going to take until I was reading that article. And I love research, and I'm a complete library nerd, so it didn't bother me that I had to do a lot. But yes, I did. I read a lot of period books. In fact, I didn't read anything that had been written after 1945 for the first 3 years of my writing it, so that a modern voices wouldn't influence my own style. I read newspapers and magazines, and mostly that was just to give myself a sense of just how people looked at things and what the priorities were, and to give myself a sense of, you know, what kind of people I wanted to inhabit this story. But once I had a sense of that, it was just easy and fun, because people are people are people, and just we just don't change. We like to think we do, but we don't. I mean, we've got the same concerns and the same fears now as we had at the beginning of the 20th century, as the beginning of the 19th and the 18th. I mean, and that's what makes it so fun to write, is that we have these concerns that maybe over different time periods change a little bit because the context changes, but at heart and at root, we're the same humans. And so in that sense, it's not intimidating to write from a different perspective, a different time period, because I'm the same as they were. So,
right here in the black.
Myla, I have to ask you where you got your inspiration for the mom in the Bee Season and her quirky, weird thing that she did with breaking into homes and storing it. I mean, it was just such an interesting character, and kind of caught us all off guard, I think, when we kind of figured out what she was really doing. But I'd love to know your inspiration for that.
It caught me off guard too. I knew that she had issues, shall we say. I didn't know she was that deeply estranged, and frankly, it was kind of frightening to find myself writing her. One thing I do assure people is, it's not my mom. It's okay. It was not an autobiographical book by any stretch of the imagination. I'm fine. My family's fine. My parents, you know, it's cool. What I do say, though, is that as a writer, I tend to be driven by my own fears, my own curiosities, and my own interests. And in the case of Miriam, I always have been interested in mental illness and in psychology. And I think my interest there kind of led me toward creating a character like her.
Gentleman with his hand up, white.
I'm curious if either of you have any favorite authors that perhaps in any way influence the way you approach writing fiction.
You do it. This is maybe my least favorite question.
Oh,
do you like this one?
I'm happy to take the question. Yeah. The thing that's tricky about someone asking about your influences is the people that influence you the most, you probably have no idea. I can't tell. I don't think about that too much. I know that I'm influenced by absolutely everything that I read. I can tell you writers that I admire quite a lot. When I was writing Wicked's Remedy, the two writers who had a huge influence in terms of how I was writing it were Vladimir Nabokov, who is a very favorite writer of mine, in his book Pale Fire, which has kind of annotations in his book that kind of tell a story, and the work of John Dos Passos, whose USA trilogy and the way it was structured very deeply influenced the way I wrote this particular book. In terms of longer lasting influences, I would probably say Dr. Seuss, Roald Dahl, and maybe J.D. Salinger.
I usually cite poets, whose use of language inspires me. So it's not so much about writing novels, but it's their use of language. And for me, that's Walt Whitman and Pablo Neruda in translation, side-by-side translations. I like Billy Collins a lot, actually. Helps me go to sleep at night. And in terms of writing style, I'm an enormous fan of M.F.K. Fisher, who wrote nonfiction. And wrote in this, I think, a very pure, clean American style that I admire. And again, I reread as regularly, at least once a year, I try to reread one of her shorter books just to cleanse the palate.
Another question? Right in front here in the purple. Please wait for the microphone.
I'm curious about the voices of dead people that you were talking about. Why did they creep into your book, and how do you do them, and what do they do for the reader?
Well, they crept into my book, as I was mentioning with the last question. Nabokov had a lot to do with it, because I so liked what his kind of extra textual stuff was able to achieve, and the idea that you could have different voices doing different effects. For me, writing this book ended up being a lot about exploring memory and its faults. And so, the problem with having just one main text is you're only getting one perspective. And the more I was writing, the more I was like, but wait, there's other ways to look at this. I mean, who knows whether it was really a red couch that they were sitting on, or who knows if this really happened. So having these marginal voices provided me with a really fun and, I thought, pretty exciting way to address the fact that there is no one way to tell a story. It does present a challenge to the reader, and I thank every reader who opens the book for giving it a try, because they're there and they're kind of like poking at you while you're reading, like, no, leave me alone, I'm trying to read here, you know. So it's a challenge a little bit, but I'm hoping it's a rewarding one, because it kind of gets you into that mode of kind of thinking about your own memory and thinking about ways to tell a story. So
right in the center here.
Hi, this is a question for Myla. I was wondering what it was like to have your novel, your first novel, optioned and made into a movie, if that was a horrifying process, or just your perspective on that. And I also wanted to know from Anita if The Red Tent was ever, is someone going to ever make a movie about The Red Tent, or what the status is with that? It'd be great. I'm looking forward to getting inside the rental unit where all that stuff is. That's in B season, so I'm looking forward to seeing that.
Well, being a movie pretty much happens on another planet, as far as I'm concerned. Like, it's planet movie land, you know, and like I'm over here on planet Earth, and like it's its own thing. I really had nothing to do with it except that I took their money and said thank you very, very much. But that said, they've treated me very nicely, and they're all big fans of the book and really did want to try to be loyal to the story, which I think is more than most authors get. So,
The Red Tent was actually optioned for, it was owned by a small production company for 4 years, and the option lapsed. It's all about money. It's all about raising enough money, getting a big enough bankable star, getting a screenplay, and nobody has managed to put together the screenplay that anybody wants to put the money behind. And my feeling about it is better no movie than a bad movie. I'd be happy to take the money at some point. So it's like, if it happens, that'll be great. And if it doesn't happen, I'm okay with that too. So we'll see.
Gal right back here with her hand up.
Thank you. I had this question really for both of you to answer. As far as working, do you work on a rigid schedule, or how does the rush of inspiration go with the working it through? And also, how much is there time alone, and how much do you need a community?
Writing's very solitary. Actually finished this book with my friend Stephen McCauley as he was finishing his book. I finished The Last Days of Dogtown sort of in a study hall with another writer. We were both sort of panting toward the end, and he was in one room on his laptop and I was in another room on my laptop, and we would work for hours and then get together and complain and then go back and get together. But it's a very lonesome. I'm not an 8 hour a day kind of writer. Actually, most of my writing career, I've been working on two things at the same time, either journalism and nonfiction, or a nonfiction project and a fiction project. So, and that's actually good for me, I think. I need to have both sides of my brain working at the same time. That's the way one of my editors put it. So, I don't have a lot of, there's this term, Sitzfleisch, which means sitting flesh. So I'm out of my chair a lot. So I work for a couple of hours, and then I have to, you know, do the dishes or do the laundry or take the dog for a walk. Yeah, I don't know if you have a dog, but I couldn't be a writer without a dog.
And I definitely have a different approach. I'm a total fascist when it comes to like scheduling time to work. I'm very, very disciplined, and I think without that discipline, all would be lost. If I waited till I was inspired, I would never get anything done. You kind of often have to work into the inspired moment. You start out the day feeling really crappy and thinking that just nothing you write is worthwhile, but then you've been working for 2 hours, and all of a sudden you get a glimmer of something and you pursue it. But if you hadn't put in those 2 hours where you weren't feeling inspired, you would never been able to get there. So you can't wait for it to happen, you have to make it happen. And I treat it like a full-time job. I mean, it is my full-time job. I was able to quit my day job. All I do is write, and I treat it that way. I work 6 hours a day, and I just make myself sit in the chair and, you know, see what comes out.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't wait to be inspired. You have to sit down. You absolutely have to sit down every day, some amount of time. And there are bad days and sometimes bad weeks. And then you have a good couple of hours, and then you go back.
Over here in the corner.
Hi. As I'm younger, I kind of wonder how you fall into your careers, and I wonder how, if you knew when you were younger that you'd like to be writers, or how that came to happen for you, both of you.
I wanted to be an actress when I grew up, but then I went to college and I didn't like the acting department, so I became a comparative literature major, and then I have a master's in English, and I kind of thought I'd be a teacher for a while, but teaching is too hard. It's really too hard, and I moved to Boston to be a poet, but you can't make a living as a poet, so I became a journalist, and I learned, and so I didn't plan my career. My career opened before me. I was a journalist for the Boston Phoenix and then a freelancer for all kinds of publications for over 20 years, and then dabbled in and wrote nonfiction books about Jewish life, and then wrote and started writing. I didn't think I had anything to say in terms of fiction until I was over 40. So my career has sort of, I found it as I go along, and now I'm working on a play and song lyrics, and I wouldn't have predicted that either. So it wasn't planned. Didn't go to school for this.
All I ever, ever, ever wanted to do was be a writer. Like, when little kids were playing school or house, I'd be sitting at an electric typewriter pretending to write a novel. Like, this was fun for me. So, yeah, it's all I've ever wanted to do. I've been doing it all my life, and I'm just really happy it worked out, because otherwise I have no idea what I'd be doing right now.
So I hope you got from that lesson how you want to proceed, right?
Why don't we have one more question right in front here?
Hi. I was wondering if you read your reviews, and if so, how do they influence you in your writing?
I read my reviews. sometimes I wish I didn't. I actually have been very little reviewed, I have to say. So do they influence me? They hurt when they're not nice, and they feel good when they're nice. So, you know, I'm still going to write what I'm going to write. I don't feel like it. It's going to stop me or change anything. And also, by the time the reviews come out, I'm done. I've been done with it for a long time. I'm on to the next thing. So while it has an impact emotionally, it doesn't change the book I've just written, and it's not going to change what I'm going to do next either. So,
yeah, what she said. I do read my reviews, mostly because I can't stand the idea that I might be in a bookstore and there'll be people whispering, "Did you read one?" And I won't know what they're talking about. That would be terrible.
Yeah.
And then the other thing about reviews is I actually believe that the reviews, like, for me, the ideal review, and they do happen from time to time, is a review that I as an author can learn something from. I think the well-written review is going to be tell you what you did a good job at, but also tell you what you didn't do such a good job at. And my hope is that by reading reviews, I'm actually going to help make myself a better writer for the next time around. So.
Well, my Aunt Leora read both these books and reviewed them for me, and she said they were terrific. So why don't we head upstairs and meet the authors? Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.